I'm Tom Kay, the founder of Finisterre. In 2003, I started a pioneering outdoor clothing brand born from my love of the sea and a deep belief there's a better way of making product. Driven by sustainability and innovation, as well as building a great culture, it's pushed me harder than I ever imagined. We believe that by connecting people to the sea, we can inspire people to take action and protect it. You protect what you love. We build products to enable this connection, celebrating incredible stories of the sea, and are constantly pushing the boundaries in all we do, come hell or high water.
My name is Lawrence Stafford, and you're listening to Hell or High Water, a Finisterre podcast exploring the depths of our oceans and the resilience of the human spirit. Welcome back to the show. It's March, and as we continue to celebrate International Women's Day and month, we've dug out something in way of a special guest-hosted episode recorded last year that is yet to see the light of day. A beautiful conversation between two friends of Finisterre, Demi Taylor of London Surf Film Festival and Sashi Cunningham, surf filmmaker, photographer and journalist from San Francisco Bay Area. Demi and Sashi dive into and discuss at length Sashi's Sea Change documentary, a film about female empowerment, competitive surfing and equity in the big wave arena. Here we've got an insightful conversation about two lives spent submerged in the sea and surf culture, creativity, cold water and the power of film. I'll keep things short and we'll hand straight over to Demi and Sashi. So without further ado, here's episode 27 of Hell or High Water.
Hi, I'm Demi Taylor. I'm a writer, producer, the director of the London Surf Film Festival, and your guest host for this edition of Finisterre's Hell or High Water podcast. Joining me is Sashi Cunningham. Sashi is a highly respected big wave water photographer, journalist, professor, and Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker who uses storytelling to affect social change. Her latest feature, Sea Change, is currently in production and explores gender equity within the world of surfing. It's an intimate journey following four of the best big wave female surfers from around the world: Bianca Valenti, Kiala Kennelly, Paige Arms, and Andrea Muller, in their fight for equal access and equal pay in one of the most dangerous sports on earth. Their surprising, history-making victory is only the beginning of what becomes their ultimate mission: equity for women in the world of professional sports and beyond. Join me as I dive headlong into a free-flowing conversation with Sashi that takes us body surfing, big wave riding, independent filmmaking, and begins on an iconic day at Waimea Bay.
Yeah, I wanted to start by just saying I'm so delighted to finally get a chance to meet you and to talk with you, because I've been following the Sea Change journey for some time. And I recently saw that you were in Waimea filming, which felt incredibly significant given the story that you're telling. And then I saw your article in the New York Times and it made me go, this is really the moment to speak to you about the journey you've been on. But I think before we get sort of into the film, I'd really like to know, what was it like that day at Waimea?
I mean, it was electric. It was, the bay only comes to life. I mean, I don't live there, so I don't know how rare it is really, but from what everyone was saying and, you know, what I've observed on Surfline or whatever is and from afar is just that these days when the bay come alive like that are very rare. And from the shore, I mean, I'm not going to lie, I was a little envious of the people on the water. I would have liked to be in the water, but I had a story to tell on the shore, which was to be following all four of the women as they got ready. And then they went in the water and talking to, you know, their friends and relatives about the significance of being, you know, among the six first women to ever compete in the 37-year history of the event. So, yeah, so it was, I mean, it was, well, okay, to be honest, though, from the shore, it's really hard to see anything. So, because it's just, you're at basically sea level. And so you, it's And you, if you watch the broadcast of it, you know, the drones and the people who are on the hill are the angles that you're going to see the waves the best. So you could kind of see the tips of people. And there was just so much energy in the water that day. I mean, it looked terrifying from shore. And then there were a few waves that just totally wiped out the crowd. The crowd, from what I heard, was not allowed to be where they were at the last competition. They were right up, you know, to the shoreline. And so my crew was also there. And unfortunately, my sound guy just got wiped out and knocked over, and all of his gear was destroyed. So that was a big hit to the everything. but it's okay. We carried on, and we were able to jerry-rig another sound rig, sound recording situation, but it was just like, I mean, from a production standpoint and from a low budget production standpoint, it was very challenging because I only had two. I had a crew on the hill that was shooting the surf, and then I had a camera and sound person that I was running around with on shore, but it was like a football sized field of where the competitors got their jerseys and where they went in. And then it was four women I was trying to follow. So it was like running back and forth on sand, of course, which is not easy to run on, and then trying to get interviews with them after and try. So it was a challenging production day, but I'm very grateful that we saw it happen and that I was able to capture it. And I think it will be a good ending for the story. Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, because I think the power of the water at Waimea is something else. You said you didn't go in that day. Have you surfed there? Have you body surfed there at all? Or
no, I've only shot photographed there. So I've swam out there back and forth, and only very little, only three times. So I also, I don't know. I didn't. I think I'm. Maybe I could have gone out, but I don't have the same relationship with the wave as, I mean, the photographers that went out that day are really experienced with that wave, and you know, have relationships with all the lifeguards. And the last thing I want to be is a liability on a day like that. The lifeguards were so busy just saving the surfers and, you know, getting them back to the lineup after their waves or wipeouts or what have you. So I didn't. And when you're in the water, you also just miss a lot of shots because you're at sea level. So you can just have the tiniest little lip of water, though it can be a 50-foot wave, but it doesn't matter because there's this like 6-inch little, you know, lip of water that comes right in front of your camera. And so you miss a lot. So, it was exciting. It was historic, as we know. And I was thrilled for everyone. And of course the, you know, Luke winning, that was just such a lovely story to cap it all off, that a lifeguard on duty won it.
Yeah, incredibly fitting. So I suppose we should probably loop back to the beginning, because obviously I followed your journey. I mean, how would you describe this project in your own words? Could you just sort of summarize She Change?
Yeah, so it's a story about four women big wave surfers who have fought for pay equity in one of the most dangerous sports on earth. And so I started following them 8 years ago at an invitational event at Mavericks that invited about a dozen of really the only women surfing big waves on the planet at that time. And these four women were among the best that day, were clearly among the best that day. So I, and they also just formed a natural friends group among each other. And so I just started following the four of them. And before I knew it, they were, they were doing amazing things. And they were, I mean, the story went to places that I really didn't envision it going. I thought it was just going to kind of be this, you know, female empowerment film about, you know, women stepping into their power on these big waves, and that would be enough. But they ended up forming a committee of, they called it the Committee for Equity in Women's Surfing, which was like a political lobbying group that asked for a heat at the Mavericks competition and used California coastal law to ensure that there was equal, so The California Coastal Commission is a governing body that's unique to California that ensures equal access to the coast. And so they used that precedent and that purpose of that governing body to argue that if there was this contest that was shutting down the coast for a day, that you needed to make sure that there was equal representation, that women and men were able to compete in that. And prior to them asking for that, it was only men. So so the Coastal Commission, after 2 years of lobbying, agreed to that. But the contest organizers were reluctant to that. So there's some drama around that.
On talking about the committee, I mean, they were having to try and find a, in essence, like a legal loophole.
Yeah.
Just for parity, which is...
Yeah.
It's quite a surprising way to have to lobby for an equitable position on the world stage, right? You're not able to sort of address it going through the front door, so you're having to find perhaps a backdoor route into saying, "Cooey, can we get into this party?"
Yeah, exactly. You would think that you could just knock on the front door and just logic would suffice that. Equality was something that in 2020, well, at the time is 2015 when they were lobbying for this. So you would think that that would be agreeable, but for some reason, we have a very unique brand of, or a unique culture of misogyny in Northern California. And so Northern California surfing. And the old guard was a little reluctant to make that happen. But there was this precedent also, that the U.S. is so litigious that really nothing happens unless you have lawyers behind it or laws behind it. There, from my understanding, one of the precedents to them asking for this was back in the mid-century. The Jonathan Club, which is an exclusive private club in Malibu, right on the beach, they did not allow people of color or Jewish people into the club. And so they used this same California Coastal Commission to argue for equal access. And so
and
that worked. And so.
And 50 years on, you're having to use the same. Like it hasn't evolved past that point that we're having to look back on something which feels quite historic. Really, it doesn't seem like the right way to address the situation, does it, to my mind? But
yeah, but we're women.
So we're used to it.
So then they so they got that contest where equal, a women's division, and then they did the unthinkable and asked for equal pay. And that was really the that was when everyone came down on the women and just were like, you should be grateful you're in the contest. You know, men, there's all the arguments, which I think are, worth listening to. I'm a journalist, so I like listening to all sides, but that, men make more money than women. There's more audience for the men than the women, and all of these arguments for why, and there's so few, a lot of them were just like, we barely make any money to begin with, which is also true. But, it's this scarcity mentality that I think exists in surfing writ large that was just kind of rearing its ugly head. And the women, however, knew they had a lot of pull, because if the four of them were not in the contest, there really would be not much of a contest. And so, but they put their entire careers on the line and were getting pushback, from every direction. Even their staunchest allies were pushing back, because I saw it happening. And
it's a bold move, right? It's an incredibly bold move in that. And it's sort of a classic storytelling thing, isn't it? You think you're fighting for one thing, which is the chance to be included. And actually, when you're offered that chance and it seems a little bit mealy-mouthed, you realize that actually what you're fighting for is something different. It's true parity, isn't it? It's true equality. And that looks like not just being there and being a representative, it's being treated with equality and fairness. And I guess they were...
our governor stepped in and again used law and said that if you're using state lands, you have to pay them equally. So they were victorious on that front. And so the World Surf League was reluctant in that they didn't think they had the budget to do this because they knew if they paid them equally for this contest, they would have to pay equally for all their contests worldwide. But they took the right side of history and announced equal pay. The downside is that there still is but then they proceeded to cancel the Mavericks contest. So there still hasn't been a contest at Mavericks, but that Eddie contest, I think, is emblematic, and I hope a first step towards someday having a contest here at Mavericks for the women.
That's a really interesting statement, isn't it? That it would appear that rather than invite women to surf at a spot, perhaps you could interpret it to say that they would rather not have their contest than to have women surf in that contest in parity. That's an interpretation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I like it as two journalists, we're really tiptoeing around and saying, yes, that is one possible interpretation of mm-hmm. this situation. You could mm-hmm. say that things like that happened, you know, on Bourbon Street in Louisiana, when at the end of segregation, as opposed to wanting the black musicians who'd played there behind a fence to be allowed mm-hmm. to play and interact and be a customer, they just shut that down. They went, no, actually, we don't want musicians playing here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you can draw any parity there. I don't know.
It's just come to me.
I just think it's...
I love your knowledge of U.S. history.
It doesn't go that deep. It's just, it's just an interesting subject. But, mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned four characters. So we're talking about Kiala Kennelly, mm-hmm. Bianca Valenti.
Mm-hmm. Paige Arms.
Paige Arms, of course, who I've actually had the pleasure of meeting. She came to our festival.
Oh, for her film.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. I found her incredibly inspiring and interesting. And then obviously there's Andrea Muller.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So how did the story kind of come to focus on those four characters? I mean, you've said that obviously they had a friendship group. What was it about their skill set that really stood out to you?
I mean, they were just fearless and skilled. They had the experience. I mean, watching those women come to surf Mavericks was very similar to when Albie Lehr and Ty Lenny and Billy Kemper first came to Mavericks. It was just like, holy shit, you know, I don't know if we're allowed to swear, but it was just like, oh my God, it was just like you were watching on a different planet. It's just, they were so... I mean, not to put down the skill set of the locals, but just the Maui contingent is just given their experience at JAWS. And I think just given their experience as Hawaiians, you know, that a lifetime in the water and all of that. They were light years ahead of everyone. They pushed the sport. They pushed surfing at Mavericks to an entirely new level, which was really exciting to see.
And when you're talking about that skill set, I guess it then makes it even harder to swallow that the reasons that they were given for not being included in the competition at Mavericks was that they didn't have that skill level and that it wasn't safe for mm-hmm. these women, yet they mm-hmm. were fiercely charging waves on the other side of, you know, other side of the world. Mm-hmm. How hard a pill is that to swallow?
I mean, it's not safe for anyone, really. If you're down to brass tacks, it's a big wave. It's big wave surfing, right? So, but it's a similar argument. Actually, there was we just recently did a screening in Costa Rica, and one of the women there was a generation above me, and she was one of the first cab drivers in Minnesota, and she The women back then were not allowed to drive at night because it was deemed too dangerous. But of course, the fares were the best at night. And so they banded together and successfully were able to, you know, drive whenever they wanted. So it's just this safety issue for women has is as old as we've been around. And so it's not surprising, I guess. Yes, hard to swallow, but not surprising. But I guess what's attractive to me about these women and this story is just that if anyone is going to be able to do it, it's these badass big wave bitches, as they like to call themselves, right? Like, it's just kind of like, yeah, you can't, that argument doesn't hold anymore.
No, it really doesn't. And you touched on the fact that this project's been sort of 8 years in the making. How's that journey been? I mean, I have a lot of questions in terms of the timeline. Like, how's that journey been? How have you kept your motivation? How have you kept the funding going?
Yeah, it's all been very challenging. I mean, when I started the project, I actually was in the end of a 20-year documentary project called Crutch. It's about a dancer who has a hip disability. And I swore to myself while I was making that film that I was never, ever, ever, ever going to do a documentary unless I had full funding in place. And yet I found myself in the water with these women shooting. And because I have the skill set to do everything kind of on my own, you start out thinking that it's, you know, low budget, it's just your time and your gear, and I can maybe cobble something together on my own. But filmmaking is, of course, such a collaborative thing. And it's why I'm in it, really, is for that collaboration. So that means you're going to have to hire people and raise funds. And so, yeah, but I just was like, I literally was in the water and was just like, shit, like telling myself, like, shit, this is the story of my life. Like, I have to do this story. Even though I don't have a budget, I have to start shooting. And with stories that are, you know, journalism based or real people, real time, you can't wait for a budget. Like, when things are happening, you have to capture it. Certainly, there's plenty of models of stories that are told that happened in the past that you can recreate with interviews and archival and whatever, but I was there, so I on the front line, so with a camera, so you have to press record, right? And then you kind of figure it out later, which I'm still trying to figure out. So but that's been the most challenging part, I think, is just the endurance and stamina it takes to just start the highs and lows of like getting a little bit of funding and being able to do a little bit and then having nothing and getting rejected from grants and getting rejected from funders and thinking you're never going to finish and then getting some, you know, it's just like this.
Because that's the reality of filmmaking that people don't often talk about. And that, you know, we often like want to talk about the beautiful creative process because that's the stuff that really gets us fired up. And you don't realize that when you're setting out to make a film, you haven't just got to be someone with a great vision. You have to be a great fundraiser, which is
90%. I mean, that's the thing that I didn't learn in graduate school. It's the thing that I don't think they really, it's the dirty little secret of filmmaking, is that 90% of your job is fundraising, literally 90%. Yeah. And I hate it, you know, but I'm learning to like it. I'm learning to, you know, you have to embrace it because there's just no other way forward. So
I like the fact that, you know, from what I've understood about how you've approached the project, you haven't been also shy, which I think is something that may be a trap we fall into as women. You haven't been shy about the budget you're looking for. You're not trying to make it on a shoestring now, you know. You're actually trying to make something with a budget that's commensurate with the story that you're trying to tell. How did you get to that point where you had the, I suppose, the confidence in the story to ask for the budget that you really needed?
I mean, I think just I'm 50 years old. I've been doing this for 30 years. So it's just kind of like, okay, I'm ready to work with a budget. Like, I just, I know I know I am at a level, certain level in my own work. So I want to work with other people who are preferably even better than that. And so, you know, those people cost money. And so that's where, I mean, I should say some of that budget right now is a payment for me, but that'll obviously be the first thing that goes. If I don't raise that money, I'll still make the film, but I haven't paid myself a penny in these 8 years. So, you know, so you could also argue that I'm not really taking that stand of needing a budget, because that's always the first thing that goes is your own payment, especially for women. I'm part of a entrepreneur group of women in my neighborhood, and all of us talk about that, how we don't budget salaries for ourselves, whereas men usually are not reluctant to do that. But I think there is a reluctance of that, of we're not worthy or we don't need it, or, you know, all of those trait things. But there's also a lot out now, you know, 100 Foot Wave on HBO, and there's some Kai, you know, The Life of Kai. There's all these really beautiful, wonderful cinematic storytelling experiences out there. So I think there's an expectation among audiences for something that is spectacular. And I think the women deserve that treatment. And I think this story deserves that treatment. So so that's what I'm still going for. But, you know, I still have $600,000 to go at this point. So little by little, it was $750,000. You know, a few months ago, or I don't know what it's. So little by little, I'm getting there.
Yeah, because I think when I messaged you, I went, "Oh, congratulations, the film is finished." Because I, you know, I read that line that you'd written on Instagram about, you know, filming the final scene, and you went, "Yeah, it's not actually finished yet." And I went, "Okay, all right, yeah, I totally get that." And obviously, you know, in the 8 years that you've been doing this, it's not just the length of project, it's also the evolution of that story that you've been following. And I guess that was a question that I had sort of going into sort of look at the film. I wondered if it would still have the same resonance, because, you know, that moment when we see sort of, you know, Jeff Clark at the Mavericks event, talking about women's role or lack thereof within the competition, I wondered if it would have the same resonance. And I was fortunate enough to have a little preview of the film. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. And it still absolutely hits. It doesn't get easier with that distance of time. If anything, it makes you more frustrated and more irate. But how have you seen that story develop?
Yeah, I mean, and I hope to show that arc. I mean, I think Jeff Clark has come around. I think a lot of people have come around, especially now that the World Surf League has, you know, instituted equal pay. It's just like with lots of social movements, it's the people who are closing the doors at the start are, you know, by over time, they change, right? That's really the goal. And so they are like, oh, yeah, I'm all for it. So I'd like to show that arc. I'd like to show that people have changed, because I think it's important for people to understand that they too can do the same.
So you really do feel like there has been a sort of an evolution in the way people are thinking about it and thinking about women's position within surfing?
Yeah, I think it's evolved. I think there's a long way to go, but I think it's, well, what do you think? Do you think it's changed over the last 8 years?
Yeah, I think so, just in terms of, you know, wearing my other hat as director of a film festival, I've noticed that the number of films that we have submitted, not just by women, but about women, has increased exponentially, and that the quality of those films are totally different, and that I'm not just seeing perhaps there was a certain way that women were always spoken about within a surf film, and that was always quite a soft feminine role, if you like, that traditional, very graceful, very beautiful. I actually also really enjoy seeing women surf really powerfully and with performance and taking on bigger waves. And you see a lot more of that now, which I love. We're not being presented perhaps as one-dimensional surfers, you know. I think there has been evolution. I mean, like, look at Pipe.
Mm-hmm, I mean, exactly.
Those photos that you got of Moana.
Moana. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I literally was crying in the water when I was watching her surf last year. I just couldn't believe my eyes. And she's tiny, you know, so she kind of defies stereotype. And yet can outperform, you know, or just is at the same level of anyone out there. So, yeah, it's exciting. And you know, and then I think there's what's really exciting is the younger, you know, this like, what are they calling the alpha generation, who are seemingly just unrestricted. You know, they don't have the same people telling them you can't do this. You can't, you know, I hope it seems from the stars of that generation, the Aaron Brooks and all of that, that they're just nothing's holding them back. There's no stereotype. There's no old guard. They just are doing it. And so, and we're also getting away with gender altogether, right? Is there's a movement towards that, which I think is, you know, it's great also. It's just, so I think it's just the boxes. The boxes are disintegrating, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. And I think sometimes people can be scared when those boxes disappear, because it makes them question who they are now and what their role now is. But it's funny, like, how do you classify yourself? Like, I remember going through a period when someone was going, oh, because you're a female surfer. And I was like, no, I'm not. I'm a British surfer, or I'm a Cornish surfer, or I'm a cold water surfer. Sometimes mm-hmm. I'm a body surfer. Sometimes I'm mm-hmm. a shit surfer. It's like, mm-hmm. I don't just feel like I should be classified by my gender, although now I'm also proud to be a woman who surfs. Mm-hmm. So it's a strange mm-hmm. one. Like, how do you classify yourself?
Well, I think it's as you just listed, as a multidimensional person and surfer, right? And so if you are only clinging on to, even though the film is obviously highlighting one of those boxes, she changed, right? So it is highlighting one of those boxes. So you could argue that, you know, maybe I'm not, but it's just whatever. I still think it's a dividing. It's a box that needs more attention and needs to fill more space in the surf world and in the, you know, world writ large. So I don't hesitate claiming that space. I am proud to claim that space, but I think it's, as you say, it's not the only space. It just, if you're in that space, it doesn't mean you can't also be, you know, jumping into other spaces. I'm an Asian American woman. I'm a biracial woman. I'm a cancer survivor. I'm a mental health advocate. I'm a mom. I'm a wife. You know, I don't know. I could think of some others. I'm a cold water surfer. I'm a, you know, American, definitely an American, you know. That's what I went to. When I first started doing the water photography, I started in Japan, and it was after I graduated from college, and I really wanted to explore more of what it meant to be an Asian American, because it was this umbrella that I was in, but I didn't really grow up in any Asian communities in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I am from. I was mostly just exposed to my Japanese American family. So I really wanted to learn more about all of these cultures firsthand. So I traveled to 14 different countries in East and Southeast Asia with that goal in mind, and with the goal of buying a camera and finding surf spots in all those places, if possible. But but I came back, and it was just like, you know, I'm American. Like, it's just, that said, I still, whenever I travel, people, one of the first things they say is like, you don't look American, you know, oh, where are you from? Where are you from? You don't look American. So different boxes in different places, right?
Yeah, it definitely is. It definitely is. And I think that's what I think's really interesting about you, because obviously, you know, now you're a professor, you're a filmmaker, but you've been an LA Times journalist. You've been, an assistant to A-list celebrities.
Demi Moore, your namesake. I was an assistant to Demi Moore.
I mean, your journey has been so interesting and so multifaceted. And then on top of that, you're also this incredible water woman. I mean, was your journey to reach this point where you're at now a conscious journey? Was it a very conscious decision to become this kick-ass filmmaker? Or did you end up here?
A little of both. I think the downside of being the multi-hyphenate career woman that I am is that I have always been like that. I have always been interested in everything, basically, and wanting to do everything. So as when I was younger, and even now, I still sometimes feel like I'm a jack of all trades, master of none, you know? So I think that's the downside of that. I envy people who have been, you know, extremely focused on one thing and are really, you know, masters of that. And I sometimes wish I had done that. But I didn't, because, you know, because I'm interested in all these things. So I think it's been both conscious in terms of like having goals. And I mean, I wanted to be a filmmaker from a very young age, and I wanted to, yeah, but like the professor, even journalism, that's all journalism and professor is a complete accident. I don't know how I ended up in that space. I mean, I do. I went to graduate school for documentary film, but that was housed within a journalism program. And then when I graduated, they were just starting video teams at all of these major newspapers. And so all of the 10 of us that majored in documentary, it's a 60 person program, and 10, you focus in like documentary or photo or print or long form, blah, 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 radio. And the 10 of us, none of us had any aspirations to be at a newspaper. We were wanting to be documentary filmmakers, but almost all of us got these jobs at New York Times, LA Times, you know, places, jobs that didn't exist when we started journalism school. But that was a wonderful journey. And so making films in a print world. I think that's more where I somehow found, I'm usually kind of like the only in all of the spaces I go into. So I'm like in this print world. And then I was brought on to the journalism program at SF State because of my video skills. But when I joined, I was the only video person really specialized in that. So. But yeah, I sometimes am just like, how did I get here? But that just means I have, yeah. So now I'm in a space, I think, where I'm like, where am I going from here? I'm going through a little bit of a midlife crisis, I'll have to admit. I'm looking forward to seeing, I guess I also know, have the faith that wherever I'm going, like for instance, this path with the film, I trust that it's going to take me to where I'm supposed to go next. I'm very interested in developing or just promoting women in sports in general, because that's more largely what the film is about, is equality for women in sports, women and girls in sports. And the more I learn about all the work that needs to be done in that and the benefits of that, I'm really interested in that space. So, yeah, but I don't know what that is yet, just as I didn't know I would be. There would be a job for me at the LA Times when I started graduate school, you know? So I just have to have faith that it's out there. So you kind of point yourself in a direction and head towards it, but keep your mind open to other things that might come along and take you in an entirely different direction.
That's a really nice way to think about it, isn't it? And I suppose I wonder if there's parallels with sort of your connection with the water and the sea in terms of sort of going with it, because I understand you're a body surf, which I mentioned. I body surf too, but I don't think I body surf at the same level or with the same, in the same sort of places of consequence that perhaps you have. I mean, you body surf at Ocean Beach, right?
I have, yeah. Mm-hmm. Body surfing is definitely my first love. Yeah.
And I think just for people who might not sort of understand what Ocean Beach is, you know, I've been to San Francisco and I've sort of stood on the shoreline there, and it's cold and it's heavy, and there's a definite feeling that there's potentially the odd shark out there. I mean, would you say that's quite a true sort of summary of the space, or?
Yeah, I've also learned last year that I have to, you can fact check me on this, but I heard that it's also from a lifeguarding group that it's the beach with the most drownings of any beach in the US.
Yeah, so, are there warning signs on the beach saying people drown here, do not enter?
Yeah.
And so, but with that in mind,
or enter at your own risk, you know.
Yeah. But with that in mind, you went, you know what, this is the place for me.
Yeah, I think I like the challenge, I guess. I like the cold. I do like the cold. I really like warm water too. but I like, well, cold water means there's less people, generally speaking. Rough water means there's less people. I do like less people. I do like I like the solitude of surfing and swimming and shooting. I also like the camaraderie, but when I get in, there are some spots on our coast, very close to where I am, that are extremely crowded. And I'm just like, this is not what I'm here for. But yeah, I think there's a draw to that. There's the going with the flow, and what I was just talking about in my life's journey of going in different directions. I think it probably can all come back to my mother dying when I was 19 of cancer. And, you know, prior to that, I think I had a very, very fixed idea of what my life would be. But I think most people I've spoken to of who have lost someone young have the same experience of just, you know, being struck on the head that life is short and life is not as you plan. And so you have to, you know, seize the moment and make sure you're doing what you want to do. And so I think the ocean was a obvious parallel to that mindset, and not just a parallel, like a incubator for that mindset to strengthen that, to own that, to make beauty out of that, to find strength in that, to find power in that.
Yeah, because I mean, you definitely haven't chosen the easiest route into the sea, have you? Like we said, you know, body surfing at Ocean Beach, swimming out with a camera. I mean, what is the reality of swimming out with a camera at Mavericks? It's an incredible physical reality, but it's a mental reality as well. Like, can you give me some insight into how it is to swim out there with?
Yeah. I mean, I think with both of those, Ocean Beach and Mavericks, they're just incremental also. It's not like I just appeared on like, and I'm like out there charging. It's like 8 years of little by little. So 8 years ago when I first met the women at that invitational event, that was the first time I had ever swum out there with a camera. And I still very distinctly remember what the ocean looked like to me and how terrifying it was and how just unknown. I was unfamiliar with it because it's it's very different from Ocean Beach because you're further out. It's just a much deep water, open ocean experience. It's just, you know, like you can see the shore. I mean, usually you can always see the shore when you're out at Ocean Beach, but like at Mavericks, you can see the shore, but it's just you're just kind of out at sea more at Mavericks rather than at a beach, right? There's just, so I remember how terrifying it was that first time. And it's still sometimes, you know, it's still scary. I think fear is a vital emotion to have in what we do. It's important, safe, right? But it's just incremental. So I just think, and I also remember being very scared the first time I went out at Ocean Beach. And I remember the first time I swam, body surfed out at big. I think I was just practicing swimming. I don't think I tried to body surf this one huge day. And I just remember the first time I saw that huge wave of a wall of white water coming at me, just like, well, what are you going to do? You're like, you could panic and die, or you can just like dive under and not think about it too much and just do as you know to do. And, but I think that incrementalism is just, it's important because you have to just develop that base and just push yourself a little bit more each time, a little bit more each time. And I'm still, I feel like I'm at the beginning of that, but it has warped the way I see things, because I did a water photography workshop with the staff at the LA Times, and I took them out to this place that I thought it was like a perfect little spot for us, but it was big. Like I didn't really realize it was big. Like, you know, one of them was just like, I can't go out there. Like, it's too scary. Like, it's too big. And it just was, my mind just couldn't go there. Like I had gone to a different,
because it's second nature for you, because you have that connection with the ocean. You're used to swimming, holding a drowning device above your head.
You know? That's one way to think of it. Yeah.
Well, it's not going to help you, is it?
No, it's definitely not going to help you.
You know, and you want to protect it and make sure nothing happens to that, yes. Right? That's your baby out there.
Yeah, that was, but I got caught at Waimea this season. I got, so the other problem when you're swimming is that you can't see ahead of you. You can't see where you're going all the time. So I was swimming back from shooting at Waimea, and I was following this other photographer. I thought I was going the right way, but the way the currents move there, you can just get swept really fast. And I think also in part because if I was on a boogie board, which I'm going to start using more, I think is you can still, you're raised enough to kind of see where you're going. And so I thought I was angling to the right, to the where the rocks are on the northern part of the bay there. But I just immediately was swept south to the rocks west to the rocks.
No judgment.
Yeah, I'm sorry to all the Hawaiians. I'm just showing my total ignorance and of the spot. But I then all of a sudden hear the lifeguards on their intercom like, come straight in. And I'm just like, oh God, where am I? Like, I was in a very dangerous part of that bay with like huge waves breaking. And, you know, I managed to get in without their eyes were on me. And actually one of them, Nolan, Kealana, like the best of them all had actually gotten out on a ski to like, he was ready to rescue me. But, you know, I kept like doing patting my top of my head that I'm okay, but I'm, you know, in my mind, I'm like, am I okay? But,
are you just doing it as a reflex?
The thing I'm most proud of is not that I made it into shore, is that I kept my camera upright and didn't scratch the front of the housing. That was the thing. I was just like, just don't break my house. I just, you know, kept it upright. I don't care if my bones are broken. No. I just don't want to break this housing. Or scratch the lens, scratch the front of the port.
Yeah, because it is, it's significantly heavy. I had a very short body surf at Waimea in probably a 2-foot day. And you know what? That swell jumped from us all having a really nice time to the lifeguards telling everyone just to get out, because obviously we were just a bunch of tourists, you know? Mm-hmm. But that water, even when it's small, is... it's heavy in a way that I don't understand the physics of it. It's just water, but yet it somehow isn't. It's somehow much more than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a small bay. I mean, so the water has to go somewhere. So it's just like when it's so big, all that water has to wash back out, right? So that's where all those dynamics I am new to. So, you know, I learned the hard way, but I'm still learning. I'm just a baby in that spot. And Ocean Beach is unique in that it's also, there's nothing obstructing the swells that are coming in other than the Farallon Islands sometimes at certain angles, but it's just, you get all of the energy of the swell. So, I mean, I personally just love that. When I go, I'm the bonus of training at Ocean Beach is that most anywhere you go in the world, you've got the training and experience to feel comfortable in it, because there's few places that have that same power. Puerto Escondido is similar. It's a different kind of, but that one is just concentrated so close to shore. So that also, like, all that water has to come back out. So that's a whole different cycle, but it's similar. And Nazaré is similar too, right? It's a sand bottom there that with a deep shelf.
And have you swum out at Nazaré?
I've been there, but not on a gigantic day. That's on my list.
Yeah, I spoke with Joanna Andrade, who surfs out there, and I was talking to her about, you know, basically how do you overcome that fear of surfing those waves? And she just went, you just feel the fear and you go anyway, you know. And I really love that. And I guess I'm wondering if that's sort of how you approach the whole body surfing, the whole swimming out in these huge waves. Because you said, obviously, you still feel an element of fear when you go out there. I mean, I think it's important to feel that fear. I think it's a healthy thing to feel fear. But do you think you kind of embrace those challenging situations? Do you seek them out? Is there something about it?
Yeah, that's what I'm there for, is to put myself in that challenging situation and overcome it. And, you know, you get to carry that confidence with you out of the water and in everything you do. So it's, I know from having done it, you know, repeatedly, how it charges me up. So life is a little flat if you don't seek those waves.
Yeah, totally. And is there anything, I know you said that when you surf, you quite like the solitude, but I wondered if there was something of the community that's apparent, obviously, within big wave surfing, especially within the community of women that you're now working with and sharing their story. Is that in some way part of the appeal, do you think?
Definitely. And that's actually where I think I'm going with my surfing and the photography, is the I do like the solitude. The thing about shooting is it's extra solitary. And you're like, you know, all of your friends are out there in the lineup surfing the waves, and you're, you know, 20 yards back or whatever it is, all by yourself. And you're like all there, and they're like chip, 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 chap, chat, like laughing and seemingly having like, you know, such a nice time together as a group. And you're just like, oh, I'm just here alone with my camera. And that can be nice, but I want to be, you know, in that party too. So I have started to surf the bigger waves. I haven't surfed Mavericks, but maybe someday. And I really enjoy, it's in totally different when you're surfing with the group versus shooting the group, because you're among the group and you're cheering each other on into the waves. And, you know, yeah. So I really cherish being able to not have a camera, you know, some of the time, more of the time. I think when you have the camera, it's still inevitably just work, you know, it's work while you're in the water, but it's also work when you get out of the water. And I think part of the allure and my love of surfing is the ephemeral aspects of it, of it's just beauty that, of, you know, I think most surfers value that presence that it forces you to be in, right? And so it's, with camera, you're still very much present, but you're still also there, present behind a lens and present, you know, with a story. You're still like, your mind is,
you're
going like
analyzing, okay, how's this shot going to look and how's this fitting in with a narrative, as opposed to just having that moment and going, oh, that feeling of calm or beauty or intensity is just washing over me and it's just for me.
Or it's just for us. And so that's where the camaraderie is. It's like, it's just for us. It's this shared experience as we had, as we were trying to get the sound on, you know, right? The start of this.
Sachi will always have that, right?
Yes, we will always have that. So, I think, but it's a tug of war, because there's also plenty of times that I've been surfing and just been like, oh, I wish I was shooting, or just feeling so guilty that the waves are so perfect and I'm not capturing them. But I've been, as I've aged, I've tried to quiet that voice and remind myself that there is a lot of value in just experiencing it. And the reality is, there's even research about this, is that you remember things visually more if you don't photograph them. You remember things more, period, if you don't photograph them. That photographing them actually turns off some sort of memory mechanism in your brain.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess because your brain knows that you've already stored that information to another hard drive, it maybe doesn't need the capacity.
Yeah.
To do that. Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. I had no idea. I'm going to stop taking photos on my phone.
Yeah.
Going to have to live in the moment more.
Yeah. Or just to be said, I mean, when I saw Andrea Mueller last at JAWS, and, you know, I was like, when are you going to start writing your book? Because she has such a fascinating story as well and has so many stories to, you know, tell about her life. And she's like, I'm writing it now. And, you know, I'm just like, yes, you are. And that was just like such a, she's so good at, she's just so sage of everything that comes out of her mouth. But just, you know, the happiness and confidence with which she said that, you know, I'm writing it now, is just like, that's how I'd like to be. It's, yes, I'm writing it now. You don't have to write it down, you know, in a bound paper volume, whatever. It's okay to just be writing in the moment.
Yeah, totally. And I guess going back to the journey that you're on with She Change. So you said that obviously you've got sort of still fundraising to do. Do you have any sort of end goal or any plans for the film as yet?
Yeah, well, I'm sure, as you know, as a film, a festival director, that a lot of these films now, or there's a push for films to come with impact campaigns. So we want the film to, of course, change the way people think and change lives and inspire and entertain and all of those wonderful things and bring people together. That's another thing that there's also research on, that about the shared experience that is going to the theater that we lost during COVID. You know, there's
and you can feel it. You can feel that energy. To be honest, that's part of the joy of doing a film festival is, one, you get to see the films early, and two, you get to share that experience with a whole room of people who, yeah, you do. That's that collective joy or shock or awe or, yeah, it's magnified, isn't it?
Yeah, no, there's a neuroplasticity that happens when you're with other people sharing the same experience, but also a visual, you know, in a box of a theater that... that is electric and magic. My crutch film came out during COVID, and it was so sad because I thought that part of the reward of that 20-year journey was going to be going to festivals all over the world and meeting people and having that experience, you know, and I just lost out on all of that, which was sad. But I'm glad we're in a space that we're hopefully, for now anyhow, hopefully another pandemic won't hit us or virus, but I'm glad that we're all wired, but So there's value, of course, in that experience alone, and I look forward to that. That's one of the goals. But we're also developing an impact campaign to go with the film. So because we want the film's message to resonate more than just those 90 minutes, and so we're just in the preliminary stages of that. But that's also an entirely separate fundraising that I'll be doing. But we're trying to connect with nonprofits that are working in the space of women in sport so that we can, we're just trying to figure out, you know, how the film can have the most impact. Is it, I mean, one of the things we're coming to now is one of the takeaways from the film that you pointed out earlier with the legislation, the legal loophole that the women were able to use to get this change in pay and equity is that it's a blueprint. It's kind of the film will be a blueprint of sorts of how activism and how you can use existing laws to get things done and create change. And so Title IX is legislation in the U.S. that is a little bit under, you know, that we're hoping this might be able to kickstart some action on Title IX, more equality for women and girls in sports and education. So that law says that any any educational institution receiving government money has to have equal money going to men and women sports programs. But it has a long way to go. So that's one area where I'd like to see some change. There's also, you know, mentorship is another place where I can see change happening. But we're just a scrappy film crew. You know, there's nonprofits that have been, like Billie Jean King's Women's Sports Foundation has been working in this space for 50 years. So there's people who have been doing a lot of work in this area. So we're hoping to connect. Right now, we're just kind of in an exploratory stage of trying to figure out who we can work with to make the film resonate more. Because we're developing this impact campaign before the film is finished, there's an opportunity there to also have the narrative really be focused on, you know, heightening that impact. If as we learn more about what needs to be done and where people have already seen success, we can highlight that or through the narrative or through people that we interview and things like that. So that's the goal. I have funding now working with my editor. I have funding in place to be working with her for a few months at least. So that's exciting. And I'm not teaching this semester. I've taken an unpaid leave. So I'll have until fall of next year to be doing this full time. So I'm just fundraising simultaneously with working with my editor and working on this impact campaign. And I'm determined to get to the finish line.
So I guess you haven't got your completion date set in stone. You just have your hopes.
The goal is to have something to submit to Sundance in the fall of next year. So that's the goal. It's a lofty goal. It means I'll have to raise. The only way that can happen is if I raise my budget. So we'll see. But I do want it to. I can't have another 20-year project. I also just think the message is too timely to. I just think it needs to happen. So I'm just going to have faith that it will.
And on that, you know, you've mentioned fundraising and budgets. Mm-hmm. If we have a benevolent listener today on the podcast, how can they help support this project?
They can contact me directly at seasachi@gmail.com, seasachi@gmail.com. I'm on Instagram at seasachi, seasachi. And then the film website is shechangedthefilm.com. So SHECHANGE, thefilm.com. And on there is a tab for donate. And there's, we have a nonprofit fiscal sponsor that the money can, you know, be tax deductible and goes through. And so you can donate directly through that site if you just wanted to give anything. And actually, there has been some lovely people that have, you know, put in $25, $100. It all adds up. We haven't done we haven't done a Kickstarter or a crowdfunding. I guess that would be a last resort, but I did that on my last film, and it's great. It's also a lot of work and
it's nerve-wracking.
Yeah, just the work v value. I don't know. It's a toss up about that. I'm hoping to get this done without that, but that might be the way we go. We'll see.
Brilliant. Well, I hope that we get to bring the film to the UK. I'd love to, you know, share this film with our audience in London. So
I would love to go to London.
Yeah.
It's such a lovely city. I haven't been in a long time. And and I've never surfed there. I'd love to surf there. And yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you'll have to make the trip over to the UK. We can, you know, do the screening in London. You can come down to Cornwall, come and surf with us in the Badlands.
I would love that.
Yeah, no, that would be amazing.
And are you going to get into bigger waves? It sounds like you have a little desire there.
I think I'm chicken. I think I know who I am. I think I love watching bigger waves. I think there's a difficulty with forcing yourself over that ledge. I think, like with many people, I hold myself back.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I like to that what you said about you know who you are. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's just there's a screw loose and the people that want to. So I think that's a good thing.
I don't know. Yes, it's horses for courses, isn't it?
Yeah. Never say never.
But this is the thing, right? I never say never. But yeah, I think maybe there was shame in not wanting to surf big waves. But then you just go, you've just got to be who you are, you know?
Yes, exactly. 100%.
Some days I surf, some days I body surf, some days I take out a mat.
Yes, exactly.
You just got to
be the multifaceted woman that you are, right?
Totally. Oh, well, yeah. Sashi, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise.
Keep charging.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that one. Thanks to Demi and Sashi for jumping on and sharing their stories. Two fantastic women of the sea, unapologetically claiming their space in lineups around the world. Thanks to Gareth at Chatterbox Audio for stitching the show together. Sound by CJ Mirror. If you're listening via the usual podcast platforms, subscribe to be the first to know about upcoming episodes. Until then, enjoy.